Does this work?
Oh, it does. Brilliant. Hiya, I'm David Garrard. I work for English Heritage. If I'd realised there was going to be that much musical introduction, I'd have slipped out for the drink I'd been wanting. But in my real life, I work for the bit of English Heritage that lists listed buildings, and you'll be relieved to know that this one, we've already covered this one, it's Grade 2 star listed, so you don't need to worry about it. I'm going to tell you a bit about the history of the church. I'm only the warm-up man, so I won't be too long about it. But if you get, if your attention wanders later on, then armed with this knowledge, you can gaze into the middle distance with more profit and enjoyment. I'll start with a little social and historical background. I'll tell you a bit about the architect, and then I'll talk a little bit about the architecture of the building itself. I should be through in about 10 minutes or so, and after that you can ask me questions if you want to. So here we are amid the mean streets of Dalston E8. But St Barnabas was actually established by one of England's major public schools, the Merchant Taylors, who in 1890 acquired a plot of land behind some factories in Shacklewell Row to build a mission house and chapel. The original mission house is the two-story building that you pass on your way in with the big Gothic window on the first floor. It was very much the done thing at this time for public schools, Oxbridge colleges, and other elite institutions to establish these sort of frontier outposts in the London slums, partly to do good works spiritually and socially. There's the photo you can see at the back of the Sunday school that was run here, and there were other sort of good deeds being done and God's word being preached, and partly also to give their privileged students a glimpse of how the other half lived. Usually there was at least one full-time missionary priest, assisted from time to time by deputations of scholars from the parent institution. Another example in this part of London. There's got to be a better way to do this. Can you hear me without this? No? Okay, I'll keep. Another example in this part of London is the old Eton College mission in Hackney Wick, just by the flyover in Hackney Wick, with a huge church by G.F. Bodley. What the native Dalstonians and Hackney Wickites made of all these public school boys turning up and trying to help them, goodness knows, but it was very fashionable at the time. One of the Merchant Taylors boys who came out to the mission in the 1890s was one Charles Herbert Riley. He didn't look like that then. I think he was younger. But who later went on to become the architect of this church. And now Riley was one of those architects who managed to become quite well known without actually building very much. His list of independent works is tiny. Apart from St. Barnabas, there was a group of cottages at Port Sunlight on the Wirral, a few war memorials, that's the one at Accrington, he did one in Durham as well. Students' Union building at Liverpool University, a bunch of small country houses, but apart from that, not very much. Really didn't do very much actual architecture. He really made his reputation, his name, as an educator and a sort of all-purpose fixer-upper, cultural mover and shaker. After beginning his career with the architect Stanley Peach, who mainly did power stations, if you know Mayfair at all, you may know this rather snazzy little Baroque substation just off Duke Street, which Riley had a hand in when he just graduated. After doing serving a few years with Peach, he at the age of 30, he landed the professorship in architecture at Liverpool University. It had recently been established, new department of architecture, first in the country at a university. There's Riley amongst his students, and he stayed there for the next 30 years till he retired in 1933. Under his aegis, the Liverpool School of Architecture became one of the most important in the country, and the curriculum he established there, which was based on his enthusiasm for the sort of grandiose but rational classicism, the American Beaux-Arts school of classical architecture. Think Grand Central Station, think McKim, Mead and White, sort of big columns, big scale, everything sort of large and simple. That was That was Riley's thing. He helped bring that style to the UK, and through teaching at Liverpool, through teaching this kind of architecture at Liverpool, he had a great influence both on the appearance of Liverpool as a city and on architectural education across the UK. Indeed, he's credited above all else with making a university degree into the thing you had to do to become an architect. He went to university, but he studied engineering. He learned his architecture as an apprentice in his father's firm. After his time, architects increasingly took a university course in architecture and then went on into practice, and that's something that he was very influential in bringing about. He was a finalist in the competition to design Liverpool Anglican Cathedral. That's his sort of St. Paul's-influenced Baroque design, which, although it wasn't built, Giles Gilbert Scott's Gothic design won in the end. But Riley's design had a great impact on other designers at the time. Both on Edwin Lutyens' design for the Catholic Cathedral down the road, which also wasn't built, but you can see the model of it there. Lutyens and Riley were great friends and went around India together when Lutyens was doing New Delhi. And also on other Liverpool buildings, like the Mersey Harbour Board offices at Pierhead, where they borrowed Riley's dome. And you can see it's a very similar way of adapting St. Paul's dome to a different setting. Riley was an ardent, if rather champagne-fueled, socialist from his student days, but he didn't have any time for what he saw as the backward-looking, sort of artsy-crafty ethos of William Morris and co. The US architecture that he admired and imitated was a kind of high-tech classicism, all impersonal grandeur, steel framing, machine-like finishes, the kind of thing you see here at early New York skyscrapers. Like a lot of left-leaning classicists of the time, Le Corbusier was one, started out as a classical architect, ended up as a modernist. Riley, too, ended up as a convinced modernist. And from designing sort of US Beaux-Arts-style buildings like this one you see, Devonshire House on Piccadilly, which is still there, which he did with the great US architect Hastings, he went on to become consultant on a number of early modernist schemes, most notably Peter Jones in Sloane Square, which is one of the iconic avant-garde buildings of the 1930s, which was designed by Riley's former pupil, William Crabtree. Another aspect of his socialist leanings was his interest in the collective enterprise of town planning. He persuaded his friend and patron, the Lancashire industrialist Lord Leverhulme, to endow the UK's first university department of civic design at Liverpool University. And his planning principles had a great deal of influence on the way that Merseyside was redeveloped in the years after World War II. This is his plan for Birkenhead with what were called the Riley Greens, sort of complexes of small houses round these sort of urban greens that was very influential on planning policy in the post-war years. Riley's early involvement with the Dalston mission went beyond schoolboy idealism. His autobiography gives a marvellously poignant story of his liaison with the missionary priest's sister, whose name we don't know, and I couldn't find a picture of her, unfortunately, but he described her as a robust, if tiny, figure with light Irish eyes and black hair and a quick, sympathetic intelligence. She was 4 years older than him, and she introduced the infatuated teenage Riley to the world of literature, to the poetry of Matthew Arnold and Walt Whitman, the writings of Thoreau and Emerson, the novels of Turgenev and Dostoevsky, in short, all that one ought to have been told about at school and wasn't. They corresponded weekly during his student years at Cambridge, and when he returned to London, they began a doomed love affair, culminating, thanks to apparently a long evening walk around the Stoke Newington reservoirs, in an engagement from which she released him a week later by a letter written in pencil from the train to Scotland. And that, says Riley, was the last I heard from her in 40 years. Everybody say aw. If bittersweet memories of all this lingered with Riley as he was working on the design for St. Barnabas in 1909 and 1910, it doesn't show. very tight budget put the grand classical manner that he most admired entirely out of his reach, and he went instead for a stripped-down version of a Byzantine basilica, complete with a concrete barrel vault and saucer-shaped dome that you see more clearly in this this long-range photograph. The Byzantine style had briefly been popular in the 1840s and became so again around the turn of the century due to a mixture of fin de siècle exoticism and advances in reinforced concrete construction that allowed people to build great big concrete barrel roofs like this much more easily and cheaply. The style's usually associated with vivid, stripy brickwork and lavish mosaic decoration of the kind you see at the Greek Cathedral in Bayswater, for example. But Riley uses it here in a pared back, nuts and bolts kind of way that makes St. Barnabas look almost more like an industrial building than a church. You see it there in that early photograph, minus some of the sculptural decoration that was later added by the Liverpool sculptor and artist Tyson Smith. It's this tough and functional-looking aesthetic of plain stock brick, reinforced concrete, with all the effect coming from pure proportion, contrasts of light and dark, that has made the church very popular with the critics, who've seen it as prefiguring interwar modernist buildings like Battersea Power Station or the underground stations of Charles Holden. The critic Ian Nairn called this the best church of its date in London and suggested wistfully that England could so easily have stepped over into modernism from here instead of relapsing into an eclectic fog. But Riley always liked his modernity with a reassuring dash of tradition, just a little wisp of eclectic fog, if you like. You see it here in his design for a new building for the Liverpool Architecture School, in which a gigantic Doric column stands like a kind of ritual totem pole in the middle of a very Bauhaus-looking courtyard. And at St. Barnabas, the hardness of the architectural shell is softened by a core of vivid colour and lively decoration. Much of it provided by his friend, the Liverpool sculptor Tyson Smith, as I said. You see it in the brightly painted chancel screen with Smith's later figures added at the top. These very beautiful, almost Celtic-looking wrought iron gates you see here, and in the altar candlesticks with, again, more sort of Byzantine Celtic kind of decoration there at the back of the church. You can't see them, but wander up later on. Maybe because it offers some of the best of both worlds, Riley regarded it as his most successful work. The building I should most like to be remembered by, he says in his autobiography. There's certainly nothing else quite like it in London, though if you want more of the same, you could try the factory-like Roman Catholic churches built in interwar Merseyside by another of Riley's old pupils, Francis Xavier Villard, what a name. And it's great to see St. Barnabas up and running again after so many years of disuse, thanks to the energy and hard work of the new congregation. Some things don't change, though. 100 years ago this week, in fact, the Architectural Review published a series of beautiful photographs of the church. This photograph came with an apologetic caption explaining that the choir seating, which you see in the foreground, is only temporary and borrowed from another church. It's still there. Thank you very much.